By touching different parts of this map, he could trigger movements in a patient's leg, arm, face, and other muscles. One of the great discoveries Penfield made was that sensory and motor brain maps, like geographical maps, are topographical, meaning that areas adjacent to each other on the body's surface are generally adjacent to each other on the brain maps. He also discovered that when he touched certain parts of the brain, he triggered long-lost childhood memories or dreamlike scenes, which implied that higher mental activities were also mapped in the brain. The Penfield maps shaped several generations' view of the brain. But because scientists believed that the brain couldn't change, they assumed and taught that the maps were fixed, immutable, and universal, the same in each of us, though Penfield himself never made either claim. Mrazek discovered that these maps are neither immutable within a single brain nor universal, but vary in their borders and size from person to person. In a series of brilliant experiments, he showed that the shape of our brain maps changes depending upon what we do over the course of our lives. But in order to prove this point, he needed a tool far finer than Penfield's electrodes, one that would be able to detect changes in just a few neurons at a time. While an undergraduate at the University of Portland, Mrazek and a friend used electronic lab equipment to demonstrate the storm of electrical activity in insects' neurons. These experiments came to the attention of a professor who admired Mrazek's talent and curiosity and recommended him for graduate school at both Harvard and Johns Hopkins. Both accepted him. Mrazek opted for Hopkins to do his Ph.D. in physiology under one of the great neuroscientists of the time, Vernon Mountcastle, who in the 1950s was demonstrating that the subtleties of brain architecture could be discovered by studying the electrical activity of neurons using a new technique, micromapping with pin-shaped microelectrodes. Microelectrodes are so small and sensitive that they can be inserted inside or beside a single neuron and can detect when an individual neuron fires off its electrical signal to other neurons. The neuron's signal passes from the microelectrode to an amplifier and then to an oscilloscope screen, where it appears as a sharp spike. Mrazek would make most of his major discoveries with microelectrodes. This momentous invention allowed neuroscientists to decode the communication of neurons, of which the adult human brain has approximately 100 billion. Using large electrodes, as Penfield did, scientists could observe thousands of neurons firing at once. With microelectrodes, scientists could listen in on one or several neurons at a time as they communicated with one another. Micromapping is still about 1,000 times more precise than the current generation of brain scans, which detect bursts of activity that last 1 second in thousands of neurons. But a neuron's electrical signal often lasts 1,000th of a second, so brain scans miss an extraordinary amount of information. Yet micromapping hasn't replaced brain scans because it requires an extremely tedious kind of surgery, conducted under a microscope with microsurgical instruments. Mrazek took to this technology right away. To map the area of the brain that processes feeling from the hand, Mrazek would cut away a piece of a monkey's skull over the sensory cortex, exposing a 1 to 2 millimeter strip of brain, then insert a microelectrode beside a sensory neuron. Next, he would tap the monkey's hand until he touched a part, say the tip of a finger, that caused that neuron to fire an electrical signal into the microelectrode. He would record the location of the neuron that represented the fingertip, establishing the first point on the map. Then he would remove the microelectrode, reinsert it near another neuron, and tap different parts of the hand until he located the part that turned on that neuron. He did this until he'd mapped the entire hand. A single mapping might require 500 insertions and take several days, and Mrazek and his colleagues did thousands of these laborious surgeries to make their discoveries. At about this time, a crucial discovery was made that would forever affect Mrazek's work. In the 1960s, just as Mrazek was beginning to use microelectrodes on the brain, two other scientists, who had also worked at Johns Hopkins with Mountcastle, discovered that the brain in very young animals is plastic. David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel were micromapping the visual cortex to learn how vision is processed. They'd inserted microelectrodes into the visual cortex of kittens and discovered that different parts of the cortex processed the lines, orientations, and movements of visually perceived objects. They also discovered that there was a critical period from the 3rd to the 8th week of life when a newborn kitten's brain had to receive visual stimulation in order to develop normally. In the crucial experiment, Hubel and Wiesel sewed shut one eyelid of a kitten during its critical period. So the eye got no visual stimulation. When they opened this shut eye, they found that the visual areas in the brain map that normally processed input from the shut eye had failed to develop, leaving the kitten blind in that eye for life. Clearly, the brains of kittens during the critical period were plastic, their structure literally shaped by experience. When Hubel and Wiesel examined the brain map for that blind eye, they made one more unexpected discovery about plasticity. The part of the kitten's brain that had been deprived of input from the shut eye did not remain idle. It had begun to process visual input from the open eye, as though the brain didn't want to waste any cortical real estate, and had found a way to rewire itself, another indication that the brain is plastic in the critical period. For this work, Hubel and Wiesel received the Nobel Prize. Even though they had discovered plasticity in infancy, they remained localizationists, defending the idea that the adult brain is hardwired by the end of infancy to perform functions in fixed locations. The discovery of the critical period became one of the most famous in biology in the second half of the 20th century. Scientists soon showed that other brain systems required environmental stimuli to develop. It also seemed that each neural system had a different critical period or window of time during which it was especially plastic and sensitive to the environment, and during which it had rapid formative growth. Language development, for instance, has a critical period that begins in infancy and ends between 8 years and puberty. After this critical period closes, a person's ability to learn a second language without an accent is limited. In fact, second languages learned after the critical period are not processed in the same part of the brain as is the native tongue. The notion of critical periods also lent support to ethologist Conrad Lorenz's observation that goslings, if exposed to a human being for a brief period of time between 15 hours and 3 days after birth, bonded with that person instead of with their mother for life. To prove it, he got goslings to bond to him and follow him around. He called this process imprinting. In fact, the psychological version of the critical period went back to Freud, who argued that we go through developmental stages that are brief windows of time, during which we must have certain experiences to be healthy. These periods are formative, he said, and shape us for the rest of our lives. Critical period plasticity changed medical practice. Because of Hubel and Wiesel's discovery, children born with cataracts no longer faced blindness. They were now sent for corrective surgery as infants during their critical period so their brains could get the light required to form crucial connections. Microelectrodes had shown that plasticity is an indisputable fact of childhood, and they also seemed to show that, like childhood, this period of cerebral suppleness is short-lived. Mrzenik's first glimpse of adult plasticity was accidental. In 1968, after completing his doctorate, he went to do a postdoc with Clinton Woolsey, a researcher in Madison, Wisconsin, and peer of Penfield's. Woolsey asked Mrzenik to supervise two neurosurgeons, Drs. Ron Paul and Herbert Goodman. The three decided to observe what happens in the brain when one of the peripheral nerves in the hand is cut and then starts to regenerate. It is important to understand that the nervous system is divided into two parts. The first part is the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord, which is the command and control center of the system. It was thought to lack plasticity. The second part is the peripheral nervous system, which brings messages from the sense receptors to the spinal cord and brain, and carries messages from the brain and spinal cord to the muscles and glands. The peripheral nervous system was long known to be plastic. If you cut a nerve in your hand, it can regenerate or heal itself. Each neuron has three parts. The dendrites are tree-like branches that receive input from other neurons. These dendrites lead into the cell body, which sustains the life of the cell and contains its DNA. Finally, the axon is a living cable of varying lengths, from microscopic lengths in the brain to some that can run down to the legs and reach up to 6 feet long. Axons are often compared to wires because they carry electrical impulses at very high speeds, from 2 to 200 miles per hour, toward the dendrites of neighboring neurons. A neuron can receive two kinds of signals, those that excite it and those that inhibit it. If a neuron receives enough excitatory signals from other neurons, it will fire off its own signal. When it receives enough inhibitory signals, it becomes less likely to fire. Axons don't quite touch the neighboring dendrites. They are separated by a microscopic space called a synapse. Once an electrical signal gets to the end of the axon, it triggers the release of a chemical messenger called a neurotransmitter into the synapse. The chemical messenger floats over to the dendrite of the adjacent neuron, exciting or inhibiting it. When we say that neurons rewire themselves, we mean that alterations occur at the synapse, strengthening and increasing or weakening and decreasing the number of connections between the neurons. Mrzenek, Paul, and Goodman wanted to investigate a well-known but mysterious interaction between the peripheral and central nervous systems. When a large peripheral nerve, which consists of many axons, is cut, sometimes in the process of regeneration the wires get crossed. When axons reattach to the axons of the wrong nerve, the person may experience false localization, so that a touch on the index finger is felt in the thumb. Scientists assume that this false localization occurred because the regeneration process shuffled the nerves, sending the signal from the index finger to the brain map for the thumb. The model scientists had of the brain and the nervous system was that each point on the body surface had a nerve that passed signals directly to a specific point on the brain map, anatomically hardwired at birth. Thus, a nerve branch for the thumb always passed its signals directly to the spot on the sensory brain map for the thumb. Mrzenek and the group accepted this point-to-point model of the brain map and innocently set out to document what was happening in the brain during this shuffling of nerves. They micromapped the hand maps in the brains of several adolescent monkeys, cut a peripheral nerve to the hand, and immediately sewed the two severed ends close together but not quite touching, hoping the many axonal wires in the nerve would get crossed as the nerve regenerated itself. After 7 months, they remapped the brain. Mrzenek assumed they would see a very disturbed, chaotic brain map. Thus, if the nerves for the thumb and the index finger had been crossed, he expected that touching the index finger would generate activity in the map area for the thumb. But he saw nothing of the kind. The map was almost normal. "What we saw," says Mrzenek, "was absolutely astounding. I couldn't understand it. It was topographically arranged as though the brain had unshuffled the signals from the crossed nerves." This breakthrough week changed Mrzenek's life. He realized that he and mainstream neuroscience had fundamentally misinterpreted how the human brain forms maps to represent the body and the world. If the brain map could normalize its structure in response to abnormal input, the prevailing view that we are born with a hardwired system had to be wrong. The brain had to be plastic. How could the brain do it? Moreover, Mrzenek also observed that the new topographical maps were forming in slightly different places than before. The localizationist view, that each mental function was always processed in the same location in the brain, had to be either wrong or radically incomplete. What was Mrzenek to make of it? He went back to the library to look for evidence that contradicted localizationism. He found that in 1912, Graham Brown and Charles Sherrington had shown that stimulating one point in the motor cortex might cause an animal to bend its leg at one time and straighten it at another. This experiment, lost in the scientific literature, implied that there was no point-to-point relationship between the brain's motor map and a given movement. In 1923, Carl Lashley, using equipment far cruder than microelectrodes, exposed a monkey's motor cortex, stimulated it in a particular place, and observed the resulting movement. He then sewed the monkey back up. After some time, he repeated the experiment, stimulating the monkey in that same spot, only to find that the movement produced often changed. As Harvard's great historian of psychology at the time, Edward G. Boring, put it, one day's mapping would no longer be valid on the morrow. Maps were dynamic. Mrzenik immediately saw the revolutionary implications of these experiments. He discussed the Lashley experiment with Vernon Mountcastle, a localizationist, who, Mrzenik told me, had actually been bothered by the Lashley experiment. Mountcastle did not instinctively want to believe in plasticity. He wanted things to be in their place forever. And Mountcastle knew that this experiment represented an important challenge to how you think about the brain. Mountcastle thought that Lashley was an extravagant exaggerator. Neuroscientists were willing to accept Hubel and Wiesel's discovery that plasticity exists in infancy because they accepted that the infant brain was in the midst of development. But they rejected Mrzenik's discovery that plasticity continued into adulthood. Mrzenik leans back with an almost mournful expression and remembers, "I had all of these reasons why I wanted to believe that the brain wasn't plastic in this way, and they were thrown over in a week." Mrzenik now had to find his mentors among the ghosts of dead scientists, like Sherrington and Lashley. He wrote a paper on the shuffled nerve experiment, and in the discussion section he argued for several pages that the adult brain is plastic, though he didn't use the word. But the discussion was never published. Clinton Woolsey, his supervisor, wrote a big X across it, saying that it was too conjectural and that Mrzenik was going way beyond the data. When the paper was published, no mention was made of plasticity and only minimal emphasis was given to explaining the new topographic organization. Mrzenik backed down from the opposition, at least in print. He was still, after all, a postdoc, working in another man's lab. But he was angry and his mind was churning. He was beginning to think that plasticity might be a basic property of the brain that had evolved to give humans a competitive edge, and that it might be a fabulous thing. In 1971, Mrzenik became a professor at the University of California at San Francisco in the Department of Otolaryngology and Physiology, which did research on diseases of the ear. Now his own boss, he began the series of experiments that would prove the existence of plasticity beyond a doubt. Because the area was still so controversial, he did his plasticity experiments in the guise of more acceptable research. Thus, he spent much of the early 1970s mapping the auditory cortex of different species of animals, and he helped others invent and perfect the cochlear implant. The cochlea is the microphone inside our ears. It sits beside the vestibular apparatus that deals with position sense, and that was damaged in Cheryl, Bacarita's patient. When the external world produces sound, different frequencies vibrate different little hair cells within the cochlea. There are 3,000 such hair cells, which convert the sound into patterns of electrical signals that travel down the auditory nerve into the auditory cortex. The micromappers discovered that in the auditory cortex, sound frequencies are mapped tonotopically, that is, they are organized like a piano. The lower sound frequencies are at one end, the higher ones at the other. A cochlear implant is not a hearing aid. A hearing aid amplifies sound for those who have partial hearing loss due to a partially functioning cochlea that works well enough to detect some sound. Cochlear implants are for those who are deaf because of a profoundly damaged cochlea. The implant replaces the cochlea, transforming speech sounds into bursts of electrical impulses, which it sends to the brain. Because Mrzenik and his colleagues could not hope to match the complexity of a natural organ with 3,000 hair cells, the question was, could the brain, which had evolved to decode complex signals coming from so many hair cells, decode impulses from a far simpler device? If it could, it would mean that the auditory cortex was plastic, capable of modifying itself and responding to artificial inputs. The implant consists of a sound receiver, a converter that translates sound into electrical impulses, and an electrode inserted by surgeons into the nerves that run from the ear to the brain. In the mid-1960s, some scientists were hostile to the very idea of cochlear implants. Some said the project was impossible. Others argued that they would put deaf patients at risk of further damage. Despite the risks, patients volunteered for implants. At first, some heard only noise. Others heard just a few tones, hisses, and sounds starting and stopping. Merzenich's contribution was to use what he had learned from mapping the auditory cortex to determine the kind of input patients needed from the implant to be able to decode speech and where to implant the electrode. He worked with communication engineers to design a device that could transmit complex speech on a small number of bandwidth channels and still be intelligible. They developed a highly accurate multi-channel implant that allowed deaf people to hear, and the design became the basis for one of the two primary cochlear implant devices available today. What Merzenich most wanted, of course, was to investigate plasticity directly. Finally, he decided to do a simple, radical experiment in which he would cut off all sensory input to a brain map and see how it responded. He went to his friend and fellow neuroscientist John Koss of Vanderbilt University in Nashville, who worked with adult monkeys. A monkey's hand, like a human's, has three main nerves, the radial, the median, and the ulnar. The median nerve conveys sensation mostly from the middle of the hand, the other two from either side of the hand. Merzenich cut the median nerve in one of the monkeys to see how the median nerve brain map would respond when all input was cut off. He went back to San Francisco and waited. 2 months later, he returned to Nashville. When he mapped the monkey, he saw, as he expected, that the portion of the brain map that serves the median nerve showed no activity when he touched the middle part of the hand. But he was shocked by something else. When he stroked the outsides of the monkey's hand, the areas that send their signals through the radial and ulnar nerves, the median nerve map lit up. The brain maps for the radial and ulnar nerves had almost doubled in size and invaded what used to be the median nerve map. And these new maps were topographical. This time he and Koss, writing up the findings, called the changes spectacular and used the word plasticity to explain the change, though they put it in quotes. The experiment demonstrated that if the median nerve was cut, other nerves, still brimming with electrical input, would take over the unused map space to process their input. When it came to allocating brain processing power, brain maps were governed by competition for precious resources and the principle of use it or lose it. The competitive nature of plasticity affects us all. There is an endless war of nerves going on inside each of our brains. If we stop exercising our mental skills, we do not just forget them. The brain map space for those skills is turned over to the skills we practice instead. If you ever ask yourself, how often must I practice French or guitar or math to keep on top of it? You are asking a question about competitive plasticity. You are asking how frequently you must practice one activity to make sure its brain map space is not lost to another. Competitive plasticity in adults even explains some of our limitations. Think of the difficulty most adults have in learning a second language. The conventional view now is that the difficulty arises because the critical period for language learning has ended, leaving us with a brain too rigid to change its structure on a large scale. But the discovery of competitive plasticity suggests there is more to it. As we age, the more we use our native language, the more it comes to dominate our linguistic map space. Thus, it is also because our brain is plastic and because plasticity is competitive that it is so hard to learn a new language and to end the tyranny of the mother tongue. But why, if this is true, is it easier to learn a second language when we are young? Is there not competition then, too? Not really. If two languages are learned at the same time during the critical period, both get a foothold. Brain scans, says Merzenich, show that in a bilingual child, all the sounds of its two languages share a single large map, a library of sounds from both languages. Competitive plasticity also explains why our bad habits are so difficult to break or unlearn. Most of us think of the brain as a container and learning as putting something in it. When we try to break a bad habit, we think the solution is to put something new into the container. But when we learn a bad habit, it takes over a brain map, and each time we repeat it, it claims more control of that map and prevents the use of that space for good habits. That is why unlearning is often a lot harder than learning, and why early childhood education is so important. it's best to get it right early before the bad habit gets a competitive advantage. Merzenich's next experiment, ingeniously simple, made plasticity famous among neuroscientists and eventually did more to win over skeptics than any plasticity experiment before or since. He mapped a monkey's hand map in the brain. Then he amputated the monkey's middle finger. After a number of months, he remapped the monkey and found that the brain map for the amputated finger had disappeared, and that the maps for the adjacent fingers had grown into the space that had originally mapped for the middle finger. Here was the clearest possible demonstration that brain maps are dynamic, that there is a competition for cortical real estate, and that brain resources are allocated according to the principle of use it or lose it. Merzenich also noticed that animals of a particular species may have similar maps, but they are never identical. Micromapping allowed him to see differences that Penfield, with larger electrodes, could not. He also found that the maps of normal body parts change every few weeks. Every time he mapped a normal monkey's face, it was unequivocally different. Plasticity doesn't require the provocation of cut nerves or amputations. Plasticity is a normal phenomenon, and brain maps are constantly changing. When he wrote up this new experiment, Merzenich finally took the word plasticity out of quotes. Yet despite the elegance of his experiment, opposition to Merzenich's ideas did not melt away overnight. He laughs when he says it. "Let me tell you what happened when I began to declare that the brain was plastic. I received hostile treatment. I don't know how else to put it. I got people saying things in reviews such as, 'This would be really interesting if it could possibly be true, but it could not be. It was as if I just made it up.'" Because Merzenich was arguing that brain maps could alter their borders and location and change their functions well into adulthood, localizationists opposed him. "Almost everybody I knew in the mainstream of neuroscience," he says, "thought that this was sort of semi-serious stuff, that the experiments were sloppy, that the effects described were uncertain. But actually, the experiment had been done enough times that I realized that the position of the majority was arrogant and indefensible." One of the major figures who voiced doubts was Torsten Wiesel. Despite the fact that Wiesel had shown that plasticity exists in the critical period, he still opposed the idea that it existed in adults, and wrote that he and Hubel firmly believed that once cortical connections were established in their mature form, they stayed in place permanently. He had indeed won the Nobel Prize for establishing where visual processing occurs, a finding considered one of localizationism's greatest triumphs. Wiesel now accepts adult plasticity and has gracefully acknowledged in print that for a long time he was wrong and that Merzenich's pioneering experiments ultimately led him and his colleagues to change their minds. Hardcore localizationists took notice when a man of Wiesel's stature changed his mind. "The most frustrating thing," says Merzenich, "was that I saw that neuroplasticity had all kinds of potential implications for medical therapeutics, for the interpretation of human neuropathology and psychiatry, and nobody paid any attention." Since plastic change is a process, Merzenich realized he would only really be able to understand it if he could see it unfolding in the brain over time. He cut a monkey's median nerve and then did multiple mappings over a number of months. The first mapping, immediately after he cut the nerve, showed, as he expected, that the brain map for the median nerve was completely silent when the middle of the hand was stroked. But when he stroked the part of the hand served by the outside nerves, the silent median nerve portion of the map lit up immediately. Maps for the outside nerves, the radial and ulnar nerves, now appeared in the median map space. These maps sprang up so quickly it was as though they had been hidden there all along, since early development, and now they were unmasked. On the 22nd day, Merzenich mapped the monkey again. The radial and ulnar maps, which had been lacking in detail when they first appeared, had grown more refined and detailed and had now expanded to occupy almost the entire median nerve map. A primitive map lacks detail. A refined map has a lot and thus conveys more information. By the 144th day, the whole map was every bit as detailed as a normal map. By doing multiple mappings over time, Merzenich observed that the new maps were changing their borders, becoming more detailed, and even moving around the brain. In one case, he even saw a map disappear altogether, like Atlantis. It seemed reasonable to assume that if totally new maps were forming, then new connections must have been forming among neurons. To help understand this process, Merzenich invoked the ideas of Donald O. Hebb, a Canadian behavioral psychologist who had worked with Penfield. In 1949, Hebb proposed that learning linked neurons in new ways. He proposed that when two neurons fire at the same time repeatedly, or when one fires, causing another to fire, chemical changes occur in both, so that the two tend to connect more strongly. Hebb's concept, actually proposed by Freud 60 years before, was neatly summarized by neuroscientist Carla Schatz. Neurons that fire together wire together. Hebb's theory thus argued that neuronal structure can be altered by experience. Following Hebb, Merzenich's new theory was that neurons in brain maps develop strong connections to one another when they are activated at the same moment in time. And if maps could change, thought Merzenich, then there was reason to hope that people born with problems in brain map processing areas, people with learning problems, psychological problems, strokes, or brain injuries, might be able to form new maps if he could help them form new neuronal connections by getting their healthy neurons to fire together and wire together. Starting in the late 1980s, Merzenich designed or participated in brilliant studies to test whether brain maps are time-based and whether their borders and functioning can be manipulated by playing with the timing of input to them. In one ingenious experiment, Merzenich mapped a normal monkey's hand, then sewed together two of the monkey's fingers so that both fingers moved as one. After several months of allowing the monkey to use its sewn fingers, the monkey was remapped. The two maps of the originally separate fingers had now merged into a single map. If the experimenters touched any point on either finger, this new single map would light up, because all the movements and sensations in those fingers always occurred simultaneously. They'd formed the same map. The experiment showed the timing of the input to the neurons in the map was the key to forming it. Neurons that fired together in time wired together to make one map. Other scientists tested Merzenich's findings on human beings. Some people are born with their fingers fused, a condition called syndactyly or webbed finger syndrome. When two such people were mapped, the brain scan found that they each had one large map for their fused fingers instead of two separate ones. After surgeons separated the webbed fingers, the subjects' brains were remapped, and two distinct maps emerged for the two separated digits. Because the fingers could move independently, the neurons no longer fired simultaneously, illustrating another principle of plasticity. If you separate the signals to neurons in time, you create separate brain maps. In neuroscience, this finding is now summarized as neurons that fire apart, wire apart, or neurons out of sync, fail to link. In the next experiment in the sequence, Merzenich created a map for what might be called a non-existent finger that ran perpendicular to the other fingers. The team stimulated all five fingertips of a monkey simultaneously 500 times a day for over a month, preventing the monkey from using its fingers one at a time. Soon the monkey's brain map had a new elongated finger map in which the five fingertips were merged. This new map ran perpendicular to the other fingers, and all the fingertips were part of it, instead of part of their individual finger maps, which had started to melt away from disuse. In the final and most brilliant demonstration, Merzenich and his team proved that maps cannot be anatomically based. They took a small patch of skin from one finger and, this is the key point, with the nerve to its brain map still attached, surgically grafted the skin onto an adjacent finger. Now that piece of skin and its nerve were stimulated whenever the finger it was attached to was moved or touched in the course of daily use. According to the anatomical hardwiring model, the signal should still have been sent from the skin along its nerve to the brain map for the finger that the skin and nerve originally came from. Instead, when the team stimulated the patch of skin, the map of its new finger responded. The map for the patch of skin migrated from the brain map of the original finger to its new one because both the patch and the new finger were stimulated simultaneously. In a few short years, Mrsenik had discovered that adult brains are plastic, persuaded skeptics in the scientific community this was the case, and shown that experience changes the brain. But he still hadn't explained a crucial enigma: how the maps organize themselves to become topographical and function in a way that is useful to us. When we say a brain map is organized topographically, we mean that the map is ordered as the body itself is ordered. For instance, our middle finger sits between our index finger and our ring finger. The same is true for our brain map. The map for the middle finger sits between the map for our index finger and that of our ring finger. Topographical organization is efficient because it means that parts of the brain that often work together are close together in the brain map, so signals don't have to travel far in the brain itself. The question for Mrsenik was, how does this topographic order emerge in the brain map? The answer he and his group came to was ingenious. A topographic order emerges because many of our everyday activities involve repeating sequences in a fixed order. When we pick up an object the size of an apple or baseball, we usually grip it first with our thumb and index finger, then wrap the rest of our fingers around it one by one. Since the thumb and index finger often touch at almost the same time, sending their signals to the brain almost simultaneously, the thumb map and the index finger map tend to form close together in the brain. Neurons that fire together wire together. As we continue to wrap our hand around the object, our middle finger will touch it next, so its brain map will tend to be beside the index finger and farther away from the thumb. As this common grasping sequence, thumb first, index finger second, middle finger third, is repeated thousands of times, it leads to a brain map where the thumb map is next to the index finger map, which is next to the middle finger map, and so on. Signals that tend to arrive at separate times, like thumbs and pinkies, have more distant brain maps because neurons that fire apart wire apart.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.